You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 153, Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you doing this week?
Pretty good. Very busy, as usual. Maybe even a little bit more, but pretty good.
Yeah, the last couple of weeks have been pretty slim for me. I'm ready for it to slow down a little bit, and it just comes in waves, and when it crushes us, but even more so with you, Mike, now that we got Reverse and Hermon out there, I really going to try to push you to get that Unseen Realm 2 out there. I know that's...
That is a pipe dream.
Some way to get rid of your day job, if there was only a way for that to happen, that would be...
What can I say? That's what it would take. Well, more realistically, I have 6 weeks to go on my own time in purgatory. Yeah. When my online teaching will be done until the fall again, so it'll feel like a new lease on life. Believe me.
Get any feedback from your students that they listen to the show or anything like that?
You know, there are some. Some have read Unseen Realms. Some have caught the podcast or both. Got a couple that told me they picked up Reversing Hermon. So yeah, that does happen. That does happen.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
Yeah, it has a nice reach. I had one email this last week that I can't remember what program he's in, but it's at Liberty. And they have one class there. I think it's one that Gary Yates teaches, where they require Unseen Realm as a textbook. His exposure came. Yeah, it's kind of nice.
Is there any others that you know that require the Unseen Realm as a textbook?
No, not required. But you know, I don't really go around asking either, but you know, Gary volunteered that, and I've heard from a couple students to that effect.
That's pretty interesting. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, I don't want to take too long cause I'm interested in part two here. So I want to, if you don't mind, I just want to get right into it.
You're going to shuffle me along.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we might as well jump into it. This is part two, as Trey said. So please, if you have not listened to part one, you really need to listen to part one. Part one dealt with who Gog is and isn't. And I'm going to assume that listeners have heard that podcast in this particular episode because it is part two. So I won't repeat its points or necessarily even reread parts of Ezekiel 38 and 39 that I read in that episode. I mean, we'll obviously hit a few things here in both chapters relevant to what we're going to discuss today, but you know, the chapters are long. I'm not going to take the time to read through all of them or even, again, what I'd read through last time. Now, the major takeaway from part one, just to refresh the memory of those who did listen to it, is that Gog and his hordes are part of the cosmic north motif in Old Testament theology. That is, they represent evil powers of darkness in a cosmic sense. Now, that involves human warfare, again, because of this linkage, this relationship between the powers of darkness and humanity. But human participants are not the primary focus, and you need to keep that thought in mind as we proceed today. Now, a few preliminary observations as we transition into part two. Some of this, again, we'll touch on a little bit of part one content. Two observations here. Number one, the primary focus, again, just to fix in our minds, when it comes to Ezekiel 38 and 39, is supernatural evil. And that's why it doesn't matter if Gog can be satisfactorily identified as a specific person, either in the past or present or future, or not. Gog cannot be clearly identified, but that doesn't matter because the focus is cosmic evil, supernatural evil. It's also why it's pointless to try and impose modern warfare weapons into the chapter or modern countries into the narrative or to come up with some kind of silly reason why armies of the future will fight with weapons of the past, the pre-modern era. And you see all of that when you see these chapters discussed. None of that just really matters. It's all unnecessary and really pays no attention to the cosmic context of the cosmic north, the Tzafon or Tzafon idea that I talk about in Unseen Realm and, of course, that I talked about last time. So the humans aren't the primary point. The battle is a battle between supernatural evil and Yahweh's own people and land, and, of course, ultimately him. Secondly, and I mentioned this briefly last time, the Gog and Magog references are repurposed in Revelation 20, verses 7 through 9. We're going to spend a good amount of time talking about that in this episode. So if we accept the New Testament as an inspired commentary on the Old Testament, then that repurposing is significant. In other words, we can't ignore it. We have to let the New Testament writer be our guide, so to speak, when it comes to understanding Gog and Magog. Now, with all that as a backdrop, I'm going to ask three questions that I want listeners to sort of, you know, keep floating around in their head, keep oriented to. Number one, how are we to read Ezekiel 38 and 39 as to its meaning? Two, how does the New Testament repurpose these chapters? We know that it does, but how does it do it? And three, are the New Testament and Old Testament portrayals consistent with each other? Now, I'm going to start with a few key items in Ezekiel 38 and 39 that will, you know, help us to think about all three of these questions. In Ezekiel 38:4, Ezekiel 38:4 says, "I will turn you about," God is speaking to Gog here, "I will turn you about and put hooks into your jaws, and I will bring you out and all your army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed in full armor, a great host, all of them with buckler and shield-wielding swords." So this notion of putting hooks into Gog's jaws and bringing him out. Now, I mention that because we've seen language like that elsewhere in Ezekiel, specifically Ezekiel 29, verses 3 and 4. And again, to refresh your memory there, this was God speaking to the Pharaoh of Egypt. This is one of the oracles of the nations against Egypt. And we read this, "Thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the great dragon that lies in the midst of his streams, that says, my Nile is my own. I made it for myself. I will put hooks in your jaws and make the fish of your streams stick to your scales. And I will draw you up out of the midst of your streams, and all the fish of your streams will stick to your scales." Now, the listeners will remember when we talked about Ezekiel 29 in that oracle against Pharaoh, that the point of that imagery was Leviathan. Again, the great sea beast, the great chaos beast, the chaos metaphor of the ancient Near East, specifically the ancient Canaan most particularly, but also we find it in the Hebrew Bible. When will God deal with Leviathan or chaos? Well, we know the answer to that question. That question is in Isaiah 27, specifically verse 1. I'll read that. Again, this is all backdrop that I want in the listeners' minds here. "In that day, the Lord with his hard and great and strong sword will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent, and he will slay the dragon that is in the sea." So Leviathan gets what's coming to him at the day of the Lord. Okay, so these are all important concepts. There's some connection between Gog and Leviathan, and of course, the day of the Lord. So that's sort of preliminary beginning number one. Ezekiel 38, 5 and 6, the next two verses, read this. We have a listing of Gog's helpers, his compatriots. Persia, Cush, and Put are with them, Gog's hordes. Remember, Gog's hordes are from the north, the cosmic north here. But Persia, Cush, and Put are with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his hordes, Beth Togarmah from the uttermost parts of the north with all his hordes. Many peoples are with you. That's Ezekiel 38, 5 and 6. So while we noted human participants are secondary, their inclusion in the description reinforces the supernatural emphasis. And you say, well, how does that work? Well, you'll notice that Israel's enemies come from the south, Cush and Put, the east, Persia, and the west. Okay, you say, well, where's the west? Well, back in part one, we talked about the orientation geographically of Gomer and Beth Togarmah and Meshech and Tubal and again these place names, and some of them corresponded to Yavan or Javan, which is the Semitic word for Greece, or the Aegean region. And that would be west, okay, of where the battle is going to take place. So what this means is that the imagery is therefore that Israel's enemies come from the four corners of the earth. Now that should sound familiar to readers of Revelation 20 and verse 8, which says that Gog and Magog will come from the four corners of the earth. And Satan will go out, he will go to the four corners of the earth, he will gather Gog and Magog, okay, gather them all to battle. The numbers like the sand of the sea in Revelation 20, verse 8. So there's a connection there. And in the verse that I just read, Gog and Magog are specifically mentioned, but you get this idea of their helpers. Again, all the enemies there in Revelation 20 are from the four corners of the earth. Again, it's interesting because that's where, if we look at Ezekiel 38, that's what we've got. We've got enemies from the four corners of the earth. So the connection is pretty clear. Now, the battle takes place, according to Ezekiel 38:8, Ezekiel 39, verses 2 and 4. The battle takes place on or at the, quote, mountains of Israel. Now, the phrase is used elsewhere, mountains of Israel, in Ezekiel as a general reference to the land of Israel or Judah. We have it in Ezekiel 6, verses 2 and 3. Again, that one, I think, is kind of noteworthy. We'll come back to that and read that. But Ezekiel 6, 2 and 3, Ezekiel 19:9, Ezekiel 33:38, we've got 34, verses 13 and 14, Ezekiel 36, 1 and 4, and Ezekiel 37:22. That's not all the references, but just a sampling. And I want to go to Ezekiel 37:22 and read that. We read, "And I will make them," again, God is the speaker, "I will make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be over them. And they shall be no longer two nations, and no longer divided into two kingdoms." So you read a verse like that, one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel. It's very clear that, you know, it's a phrase that's just used, you know, generally for the whole land. If we go to the earlier reference that I mentioned, Ezekiel 6, "Son of man, set your face toward the mountains of Israel and prophesy against them and say, 'You mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Lord God. Thus says the Lord God to the mountains and the hills, to the ravines and the valleys. Behold, I, even I, will bring a sword upon you. I will destroy your high places.'" Again, there in the immediate context of Ezekiel, he's referring to Jerusalem and Judah. So just two samples there that, again, show a little bit of variety, but still consistency when it comes to this mountain language. Now, the chief mountain, though, in Israel, where the Lord is, of course, Zion. And we get this language in other passages in the Old Testament, Isaiah 2, okay, verses 2 and 3. Let me just bring that up. "It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be lifted up above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it." Again, Isaiah 27:13 is another one. "In that day a great trumpet will be blown, and those who were lost in the land of Assyria and those who were driven out to the land of Egypt will come and worship the Lord on the holy mountain at Jerusalem." So this is an obvious reference, Jerusalem, it's Mount Zion, so on and so forth. And I point this out because even though we have a plural reference here, mountains of Israel, the day of the Lord is still associated with one particular mountain, and that is Zion, okay, where the temple was, where the presence of God was situated, and which obviously, even though there is no temple now, is forever associated with the presence of God in the temple. And that's going to come up a little bit later, again. And I'll just telegraph it now. If you've read Unseen Realm, this is important because of the whole concept of Har Moed, okay, the Mount of Assembly. And Har Moed is behind the phrase Armageddon, right? So Armageddon is not a battle that takes place at Megiddo, okay? It's a battle that takes place at and for Zion, okay, Mount Zion, Jerusalem. And there's a whole backdrop to this discussion. But what I want to, you know, I bring it up here again to get your thoughts oriented to Armageddon. Now, if you're listening carefully now, you're thinking already, oh, wait a minute. The connection of Revelation 20 with Ezekiel 38 and 39, that Revelation 20 isn't Armageddon, because Revelation 20 verses 7 through 9 occurs after Revelation 19, of course. And Revelation 19 is where the Lord comes back on the white horse at the Battle of Armageddon to save Jerusalem and so on and so forth. Those are two different things, two different chapters. So if the Ezekiel language is associated with Revelation 20, why is Mike saying that we need to be thinking about Armageddon as well? Okay, we'll return to that. I'm just planting, again, the question in your mind, because once we get there, you'll see why this is relevant. Now, let's just keep moving. Ezekiel 38:16 situates the invasion in the, quote, latter days. And the description of the conflict uses stock expressions associated with the latter days, or that day, or on that day. In other words, the day of the Lord. Let's just read Ezekiel 38, just to give you an example. And any study in your own personal Bible study of the day of the Lord, you're gonna see language like this all over the prophets. Ezekiel 38:17, thus says the Lord God, are you he of whom I spoke in former days by my servants the prophets of Israel, who in those days prophesied for years that I would bring you against them? But on that day, the day that Gog shall come against the land of Israel, declares the Lord God, my wrath will be roused in my anger, for in my jealousy and in my blazing wrath I declare. On that day there shall be a great earthquake in the land of Israel, the fish of the sea, and the birds of the heavens, and the beasts of the field, and all the creeping things that creep on the ground, and all the people who are on the face of the earth shall quake at my presence, and the mountain shall be thrown down, and the cliffs shall fall, and every wall shall tumble to the ground. That's Ezekiel 38:17-20. Again, any study of the day of the Lord will inform you that this is stock vocabulary. This is a familiar description to the day of the Lord event. Now, on the page for this episode, we're going to post an article from Anchor Bible Dictionary on the day of the Lord. And you could read that, you could look up the verse references, and you'll see that what I'm saying is true. Okay, that this is stock vocabulary of the day of the Lord. Now, why is that important? Well, if it's stock vocabulary, the day of the Lord, and Ezekiel 38 talks about in the latter days, then this event is associated with the day of the Lord. And you say, well, Mike, what's the day of the Lord? Well, the day of the Lord, in Old Testament thinking, is the final judgment of God, when wrong is made right, when the nations that are still in rebellion, and of course their gods, remember our episode back on Isaiah 34, that you know, not only at the day of the Lord do those who are hostile to Yahweh and his people get punished, but the host of heaven also gets punished, that the house is clean there too. But this is a time of final judgment when the wrong is made right, the nations that are in rebellion and their gods are judged, you know, in a permanent sense, and the righteous are vindicated. Now, that means, and again in biblical thinking, this is called the day of the Lord because this is when God returns to earth to set things right. In hindsight of the New Testament, therefore, this is a reference, and this is the way it's used in the New Testament. This is a reference to the second coming of Christ. The New Testament uses the phrase the day of Christ as a substitution for the day of the Lord. This is the second coming. So this links, this description in Ezekiel 38:17-20 links Gog and Magog, this event, this incident, it links it with the second coming of Jesus. Again, what I'm doing is I'm giving you the elements to what Ezekiel 38 and 39 mean and describe. This is not a battle that occurs some years before the second coming. I know that's common to situate this battle in at the beginning of a seven-year tribulation or at the midpoint or whatever. I mean, some put it at the end where it ought to be, because you know, if you're looking at that system, that eschatological system, that's when the Lord's going to return. But that is when this event becomes a factor at the second coming of Christ, and not before, not years before, second coming of Christ, because this is Day of the Lord language. Okay. Now, returning back a little bit more, getting a little bit more detail in this description, at this judgment, again, the one that's described here in Ezekiel 38 and on into chapter 39, God destroys Gog and his hordes with fiery hailstones from the sky. That's Ezekiel 38:23, Ezekiel 39, verse 6. Again, this fiery hailstones from the sky. Gog and his hordes are buried in the, quote, Valley of the Travelers. I'm quoting the ESV here. East of the sea, also called the Valley of Hamon Gog. That's Ezekiel 39:11 and 39:15. And we'll have more to say about the travelers. That's actually an important part of what's going on here with Ezekiel 38 and 39. But again, get the picture. This event coincides with the Day of the Lord, which the New Testament puts at the second coming. Gog and his hordes are defeated, destroyed by fiery hailstones from the sky. Again, does this sound familiar? Again, you actually get this language in Revelation 20. Again, and you'd sort of expect it there, because Revelation 20 references Gog and Magog. So that's not really a surprise, but I think we need to point it out explicitly. Again, this event is referred to, the Day of the Lord, as the Day of Christ in the New Testament. And with respect to the New Testament and Revelation 20, again, just by way of a little summary statement here, remember, we have the enemies from the four corners of the earth in Revelation 20. They're destroyed with fire from heaven in Revelation 20. Okay? Simple enough. It's very clear that Revelation 20, verses 7 through 9, is drawing on Ezekiel 38 and 39. In Revelation 20, verse 8, Gog and Magog are mentioned explicitly. And you say, well, Mike, this is so obvious. Why are you making a point of it? Because this connection with Revelation 20 and specifically the Day of the Lord troubles people who want to associate this event with the beginning of a seven-year tribulation and a rapture. In other words, their system gets in the way of the text. And you will actually see in some writers, people say things like, well, this event in Revelation 20 is a different Gog and Magog battle, not the one in Ezekiel 38. It's a second one. It's a different one. That is bogus. The only reason people are saying that is to make their system prop up. Okay, we're not about systems here. We're about the text. Again, that if we're going to do biblical theology, by definition, it needs to be about the text, not a system that we've constructed and bring to the text and then have to adjust the text to fit the system. That's not what we do here. But you'll see that. So even though this seems like an obvious thing, we have to point it out because this is what certain writers will do. They'll just say it must be a different one, so that their system survives, okay? Now, I'm going to be a little kinder, to systems as toward the end of this episode, because there is certain systems can work within, what we're going to be doing here. This is not going to narrow into one system. So just heads up there. But we need to point these things out again, just to reinforce the idea that the text needs to be primary, and systems are put in the background somewhere. Now let's continue on with this burial. The burial language is really important, and frankly, it's kind of interesting. Now, in regard to this reference that Gog and his hordes get buried in the Valley of the Travelers, okay, this is Ezekiel 39, verse 11, 39:15. Valley of the Travelers, also known as the Valley of Hamon Gog. What's being described here? Well, there's a conceptual and a geographical backdrop to this, to what is described in these two verses, that is actually quite consistent with Revelation 20. Let's think of Revelation 20 first. That might be more familiar. So let's just go there, and I'll read it to you, and then we'll come back to the Valley of the Travelers thing. So Revelation 20, in verse 7. And when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison, and he will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth. Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea. And they marched up over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them. So we've got Gog, Magog, four corners of the earth, and then fire from heaven. All these things are in Ezekiel 38, 39. Verse 10, and the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Okay, so after these hordes that are surrounding Jerusalem and threatening them, after, you know, Gog and Magog and the four corners of the earth people, you know, they're all there, after they are consumed with fire from heaven, their leader, the devil here in Revelation 20, gets thrown in the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and the false prophet are. Well, if you go back to Ezekiel 38 and 39, what happens after, again, the Gog and his hordes are defeated with fiery hailstones from the sky? They are buried in this valley, the Valley of the Travelers, east of the sea, also called the Valley of Hamon Gog. You say, well, how in the world is that consistent? Well, we need to divert our attention away a little bit from earthbound literalism here and think more conceptually, think more theologically, think more abstractly about this. Now, Gog and his hordes, again, buried in this Valley of the Travelers place. The Hebrew reads, Ge Ha-Overim. Okay, that is literally translated the Valley of the Travelers. Now, I want to read through the DDD entry, Dictionary of Deities and Demons in the Bible, the entry for travelers. There is one, believe it or not. And I'm hoping this will introduce listeners to what's going on behind earthbound literalism in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Again, because that's usually how people approach the passage. They press what Ezekiel 38 and 39 says into some earthly literalistic scheme. There's something else going on here. So here's the DDD entry. It begins a little bit awkwardly. The participle kal, plural, that's Hebrew talk. Overim, that's the morphological form of the word. It's a kal plural participle. Big deal, okay? The plural overim comes from the verb avar, to pass from one side to the other. That's what that Hebrew verb means. It seems to have a special meaning in the context of the cult of the dead, denoting the spirits of the dead crossing the border between the land of the living and the world of the dead. It can be interpreted as a divine name in Ezekiel 39, 11, and 14. Again, going with the Hebrew numbering there, what it means by divine name there is, again, a place associated with divine beings. And of course, Gog, we've argued, is this, you know, cosmic divine being, a symbol of cosmic evil, and the human element is secondary here. So it can be interpreted as a divine name in these passages, which may also have been preserved in the geographical name Avarim. And you get that in Numbers 21, 10 to 11, Numbers 27, 12, Numbers 33, 44, and 47 and 48, Deuteronomy 32, 49, and Jeremiah 22, 20. Its Ugaritic cognate would be spelled the same way, the Ayin, Bet, Resh, Mem. And then he gives a KTU number. That's the numbering system, the abbreviation for the cuneiform tablets from Ugarit. It's KTU 1.22. And he continues, in the Ugaritic text, KTU 1.22, describing a necromantic session, the king invokes the spirits of the dead, the Rephaim, and celebrates a feast, probably the New Year festival, with them. It is told that they came over traveling by horse-drawn chariots. As they are taking part in the meal served for them, they are explicitly called those who came over. They are called Overim. So you have Rephaim referred to as Overim. Okay, are you catching a drift now? The Rephaim are associated with the underworld. In Revelation 20 language, the lake of fire. Continuing with the DDD entry. In Job 33:18, the verb avar is used to denote the crossing of the river between life and death. This represents the quite general ancient conception of a river or sea separating the world of the dead from the land of the living. For example, the Greek river Styx and the Akkadian river Hubor. In the Sumerian flood story Dilmun, the place of blissful afterlife is called the land of the crossing. Now, we'll skip a little bit, go down a little bit further in the entry, DDD. The valley of the Ovarim is located east of the sea, verse 11, Ezekiel 39:11, which is probably the Dead Sea, so it was part of the Transjordan. This is a region which shows many traces of ancient cults of the dead, such as the megalithic monuments called dolmens and place names referring to the dead and the netherworld, such as Ovot. Now I'm going to go back up to the beginning of this entry, and he gives some references here to the place, the geographical place name, and we now know it's in the Transjordan, Avarim. Here's what Numbers 21:10-11 says. And the people of Israel set out and camped in Ovoth. Okay, Ovoth is the Hebrew word for spirits, spirits of the dead. Okay, the Ov, the mistress of the Ov, is the title of the medium at Endor in 1 Samuel 28. Okay, Ovoth is therefore naturally associated with necromancy, the spirits of the dead, you know, the Rephaim dead in the underworld, and Avarim, again, here in the verse, you know, they set out from Ovoth and camped at Iyeh Avarim in the wilderness that is opposite Moab toward the sunrise. And there are a few of these references link Avarim with Ovoth. They're very close to each other. Again, these are gateways. These are considered places that lead to the netherworld, to the underworld, the realm of the dead where the Rephaim are. It's just that in this case, it happens to be in Moab, in the Transjordan. And this is the place that is referred to in Ezekiel 39. So you have Gog and his hordes winding up in the bad place, the netherworld, the realm of the dead, where the Rephaim are. Now, you're going to miss all of that if you have an earthbound literalistic hermeneutic in this chapter. And I've read lots of books about, oh, well, how many months would it take for people using shovels and backhoes, you know, to bury X number? That is not the point. This is cosmic theological language. Okay, this is the language of supernatural darkness. We get lost and fixated on the literalism that we're trying to impose on the text. And we miss the fact that an ancient Israelite reader would have read this and gone, okay, they're all going to wind up in hell. You know? I mean, that's the reference. And that's why Ezekiel 39 here fits actually very nicely with Revelation 20, because, you know, Satan goes there, and then, you know, we've had, you know, the description of the resurrection. Those who are not found written in the book of life or, you know, wind up in the lake of fire. We've had that. The beast is there. Again, it's a consistent picture. This is where the bad ones go. This is where the good ones, you know, don't go. That sort of thing. And again, we miss that when we're trying to over-literalize. Now, I would say, just by way of summary here, viewing the passage this way, again, in a cosmic sort of way, makes the connection to Revelation 20 pretty obvious. In Ezekiel 39, Gog, symbol of cosmic darkness, and all his hordes go down to the valley of the Ovarim. Where else would they go? That's where they basically belong. The valley of the Ovarim, the ones who have passed into the underworld before them, the abode of the Rephaim. Now, other scholars prefer to see the references here in Ezekiel 39 to Molech imagery. And there are some, you know, certain reasons why they refer that block, for instance, you know, takes this view. And most of his argument is really on the fact that the valley of Hamon Gog in Ezekiel 39 sounds in Hebrew like the valley of Hinnom, or at least a little bit. Here they are in Hebrew. You have Gay Hamon Gog and Gay Hinnom. And they sound a little bit alike. And Block says, well, it might be, you know, the valley of Hamon Gog might be a play on words on the valley of Hinnom. And of course, the valley of Hinnom is notorious in the Old Testament for being the place of child sacrifice to Molech. And so this is why some scholars prefer Molech imagery. Now, Bloch, again, he doesn't really spend too much time defending this. He more or less just assumes it. But the fact is he doesn't interact at all with the Ugaritic material that the DDD entry brings up. So that's kind of a gap, you know, in Bloch's commentary there. Those who prefer Molech also do so a little bit because if Molech is behind the phrasing, then the death, you know, catch this thought, it's important, and you don't need Molech for this, but catch this thought. They like it because the death of Gog and his hordes therefore becomes a sacrifice to Yahweh in reverse of the sacrifices of children at Hamon, at the Valley of Hamon, to Molech. I would say, though, that this sacrificial aspect, I think, is valid, but it can be in view without any reference to Molech at all. If you look at Ezekiel 39:17 says, "As for you, son of man, thus says the Lord God, speak to the birds of every sort and to all beasts of the field. Assemble and come, gather from all around to the sacrificial feast that I am preparing for you, a great sacrificial feast on the mountains of Israel." Now, the word there in Hebrew is zavach. It's the normal word for sacrifice. So you don't really need, you know, specifically to have Molech in view here to, you know, understand that what's going on here is, in effect, the offering of Gog and his hordes up to Yahweh as a sacrifice. Again, kind of, you know, reversing the idolatrous pattern that would have been represented by Baal worship or any worship of any other god. So again, the imagery, the language is actually there. You know, if you don't want, you know, to see Molech, if you prefer the Rephaim imagery, again, which I do, I think it makes a lot of sense, then you can still have the sacrificial element. I want to say something else about this too before we leave the point. If you look at Ezekiel 39:17-20, and I had just read verse 17 there, it turns out that Yahweh is the one killing the sacrifice for his guests. And his guests are the birds and the beasts of the field. He's the one inviting, you know, by means of the prophet, you know, the birds of the prey and the animals to the feast. Thus says the Lord God, speak to the birds of every sort and all the beasts of the field. Assemble, come, gather all around to the sacrificial feast I'm preparing for you. And then later it says, you shall be filled, you know, I'll back up a little bit. You shall eat fat until you are filled and drink blood till you are drunk at the sacrificial feast I am preparing for you. And you shall be filled at my table. So this is actually imagery of Yahweh slaying Gog and his hordes as a sacrifice, a sacrificial meal for his guests. Okay, that's what you get. Now, it's at a point like this that you'd want to return, I think, for interpretation's sake, to the hooks in the jaws description for an added dimension. Remember, the hooks in the jaws description from Ezekiel 38:4, where Gog, you know, is described in this way, like just like Leviathan imagery in other passages. Gog is described this way, and again, that links him to Leviathan, the symbol of all that opposes God, the symbol of chaos. The symbol of wickedness and evil and upheaval and turmoil, all the forces against God. The death of Gog and his hordes is, again, a sacrificial banquet for Yahweh and the righteous. But where does Leviathan come in? Right? Well, in the Second Temple period, you actually have a number of texts that pick up on this language, this imagery. And there are a number of Second Temple texts that have, for lack of a better way to put it, at the day of the Lord, when God returns to earth and defeats Leviathan, remember Isaiah 27:1, in that day, you know, the Lord's going to kill, you know, Leviathan. The thinking was that when that happens, Leviathan is basically served up as a meal to the righteous. It sounds really weird and a little bit grotesque. But this was the idea that, again, using symbolic language, that this is a picture of ultimate victory. I mean, God isn't going to just kill the forces of wickedness and evil and do away with them. You're going to have a barbecue out of it. Okay? You know, they're evil. Here's the image. Evil and chaos in the end will be totally consumed. Totally consumed. And the way to convey that idea, again, is this meal imagery. Now, that has all sorts of ramifications, I think, for the idea of the marriage supper at the Lamb. What is served at the marriage supper of the Lamb? You know, what is the meat, you know, and the drink? What is, you know, there's just a number of ways that this can go and can be taken. But it's an image. It's a picture of the final victory, the ultimate victory over evil. Again, it's not that, you know, there's going to be like literal, you know, eating and all that sort of stuff. But it's an image that's drawn from the Old Testament and even the wider ancient Near Eastern world about what's going to happen to evil at the end. It's going to be totally gone. It's not going to be wounded. It's not going to be kind of left over and, you know, all that. It's going to be totally consumed. And that's the point here. Now, I would ask, just as a sidebar, again, since this idea, this valley of the Ovarim, the Rephaim, and all this, and, you know, serving up, you know, the corpses of evil, as it were, metaphorically, you know, to the righteous, and not only to the righteous, but specifically in Ezekiel, to the birds, you know, the birds of prey and the beasts of the field, you know, it's kind of an ultimate indignity as well. And again, but this idea gets picked up in later literature as the eschatological feast. If that's the case, even if it's, you know, partly the case, let's just leave it with the birds of prey and the animals here that they consume, you know, because that's what Ezekiel says, strictly speaking. If that is a parallel, again, because they go to the realm of the dead, if that is a parallel to Satan and his minions and everybody else that goes to the lake of fire, you know, in Revelation, then what does this say about the redemption of Satan? You know, we've recently on the Facebook group, you know, had this big, you know, brouhaha over angelic redemption, which of course I don't buy. But this is one of the reasons why I don't buy it. It's also one of the reasons why I don't buy universalism. You have this kind of language that defines ultimate victory in the consumption of evil. I mean, just putting it bluntly. It doesn't communicate the idea that evil's going to get another chance. There's nothing in Ezekiel, there's nothing in Revelation 20 that suggests that Satan, his minions, and those under his power who fight against Yahweh and his people get a second chance. They don't get regurgitated, okay, so that they can get another chance. And angelic redemption, when viewed against the context of this kind of whole burnt offering or, you know, meal offering language, just doesn't make any sense. And it's not even in the picture, is the point. There are no weasel words in the passage that you can go to and say, oh, well, they'll probably still be around and you know, get redeemed later on. No, that just isn't there. It just isn't there. And you get the same kind of sacrificial language, the cherem, devoted to Yahweh of the conquest, you know, specifically aimed at the Anakim, again, the giant clans and all that. You don't get weasel words there for some later redemption. You just don't. And so this isn't the whole reason, obviously, why I don't buy angelic redemption or the redemption of Satan at some point. It's just one of the reasons I have. But I thought, you know, since we're here and we have this underworld imagery, we might as well bring it up. Now, remember as well, this gets kind of interesting, and this goes into, again, the Second Temple thinking. Who else, again, is in the lake of fire with Satan? Well, it's the beast. The beast, the beast. Why does that sound familiar? The beast. You know, we always think of Antichrist, but where does the beast, okay, of the book of Revelation, Revelation 13, come from? Revelation 13:1, the beast rises out of the sea. It's Leviathan imagery. Okay, and Leviathan, the beast, again, the forces of chaos, the forces of everything hostile to God, okay, is what this language points to. These are important metaphors that we can't dispense with. That also winds up, again, in this realm of the dead. There's no opportunity, again, for future redemption or anything else like this. Again, evil is devoured and done away with. Now, a bit of a commercial here, if you'll pardon that. I discussed some of this, actually a good bit of it, in Reversing Hermon. And there's one particular chapter, chapter 11, the one that deals with Antichrist and the imagery of Antichrist and how it's associated with Babylon and how that's the backdrop to Mystery Babylon. again, that chapter deals with a lot of this imagery and the point of origin, the reason why these things are connected. Leviathan, you've got Babylon, you've got this place of the dead with the Rephaim. Again, we know who the Rephaim are. The reason why that is important to understanding Babylon and the concept of Mystery Babylon is because of where that stuff comes from and the fact that the Apkallu, the Mesopotamian counterparts to the fallen sons of God, the Watchers, that's Babylonian. Okay, those are Babylonian good guys. All of these things go together. This is a matrix of ideas. And so when Revelation is talking about the beast and Mystery Babylon, there are connections back to supernatural forces of evil, the Rephaim, okay, the Nephilim, the fallen sons of God, the Watchers. This is a matrix of ideas. There's something going on here that our understanding of these passages in Revelation will be incomplete and in some cases go off track if we don't factor in this material. So I'm not going to get into that here. There are specifics you'll find in the book. But since we're into this subject matter, you should know that there is, you know, something of a summary of this material in the book. I'll mention another book here. If you're interested in the whole Leviathan as sacrificial meal idea of the Second Temple period, I have a book recommendation for you. It's available used. It's a volume in the Harvard Semitic Monograph series. The foreign language stuff is typically in transliteration in that series, so I think you could still read it even if you don't have Hebrew. It's a book by K. William Whitney. Last name is Whitney. And the title is Two Strange Beasts. Subtitle, Leviathan and Behemoth in the Second Temple. Okay? These are not dinosaurs, folks, please. They're not dinosaurs. These are important metaphors that are about cosmic darkness. It's so much more interesting. You know, if you just situate it in its own context, rather than trying to defend something that Ken Ham says or something, it's just so much more interesting and so much more contextually relevant. So if you're interested in this subject, I highly recommend Whitney's book. It's one of the few books that collects all the material. Now let's go back to our purpose here, Ezekiel 38 and 39. You know, we've talked about how Revelation 20 verses 7 through 10 repurposes imagery from Ezekiel 38 and 39. We've got this battle at the end. Okay, Revelation 20, this battle at the end. It's the day of the Lord. The Lord returns. He's going to finally defeat Satan and all of evil and chaos and wickedness, and they get sent to the lake of fire. Okay, the language, again, Gog and Magog is used in Revelation 20. We go back to Ezekiel 38 and 39. We find the very same themes in the latter days at the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord vocabulary. This is when this battle happens. Gog is a symbol of supernatural chaos and evil. Again, we're not denying that humans are involved in this because of the symbiosis between the unseen realm and our realm. Okay, we get that. This is what we do on this podcast. We don't look at one or the other. It's always a both and. Okay, we understand that. But if you focus on the literalism that's earthbound, you're going to miss all this stuff. You're going to miss how Ezekiel 38 and 39 get repurposed in Revelation 20 and how it describes the final conflict. Okay, when all of this is put to an end, you know, the eschatological ultimate victory. Now, having said all that, I've been holding back one thing. This repurposing is important. It's important for another reason, and there's an element of the repurposing of Ezekiel 38 and 39 in the book of Revelation that for some scholars, you know, they will use it to argue the death of premillennial eschatology. Now, I think that is an overstatement, but what I show you in what follows here in the last few minutes of the episode here, what I show you might, for some, kill off traditional premillennialism. But again, I'm going to say that that's overstated, and I'll tell you why. But it doesn't kill off at all the idea of a future earthly messianic kingdom. You say, well, isn't that the millennium. Isn't that what premillennialism is all about? Well, that's the way premillennialism is talked about. But the idea of an earthly reign of the returned Christ doesn't need to be restricted to a system. Okay, so with that, let's get into it. Here's the issue. We know that Revelation 20 draws on Ezekiel 38 and 39. It should be a no-brainer by now. It mentions Gog and Magog explicitly. You've got all these parallels. Okay, you would expect, again, John, who's writing the book of Revelation, when he gets to Revelation 20 and he mentions Gog and Magog, you'd expect him to have Ezekiel 38 and 39 in mind. Again, that's obvious. But here's the rub. John also repurposes Ezekiel 38 and 39 in the chapter before Revelation 20, that is in Revelation 19. And that's the passage where Jesus comes back on a white horse to slay the beast and save Jerusalem. John repurposes Ezekiel 38 and 39 in both Revelation 19 and Revelation 20. And if you're a premillennialist who's reading the book of Revelation in a linear chronological fashion, you're thinking, well, how can that be? Because chapter 19 is the second coming of Jesus, and chapter 20, first six verses, we've got a millennium, and then after the millennium's over, we've got this other battle. How can they both be described using the same Old Testament chapters? Okay, you got a sense of the problem. I'll explain that in a moment. I'm going to read you Revelation 19, though, so that you know that, you know, what this is based on. So here's Revelation 19, 11 through 21. Now, our focus here is going to be on verses 17 through 21, but I want to read the whole thing here. Then I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. The one sitting on it is called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and makes war. It's an interesting statement. His eyes are like a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems. And he has a name written that no one knows but himself. He is clothed in a robe dipped in blood, and the name by which he is called is the Word of God. And the armies of heaven, arrayed in fine linen, white and pure, were following him on white horses. From his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. He will tread the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God the Almighty. On his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now this is clearly the return of Jesus, all right? Now here's verse 17. Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and with a loud voice he called to all the birds that fly directly overhead, "Come, gather for the great supper of God, to eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses and their riders, and the flesh of all men, both free and slave, both small and great." Verse 19. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth with their armies gathered to make war against him who was sitting on the horse and against his army. And the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet who in its presence had done the signs by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped its image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur, and the rest were slain by the sword that come from the mouth of him who was sitting on the horse, and all the birds were gorged with their flesh. That's the end of verse 21. Now, there are only three passages in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, where a word in the root family for bird and for fly, the terms that are used in Revelation 19 appear. There's only three passages in the Septuagint where those terms appear: Deuteronomy 4:17, Proverbs 19:12, and Ezekiel 39:4. The last of these is the only one with an added lemma for eating. So it's pretty clear that John in Revelation 19 is drawing on Ezekiel 39. So here's the question: how can John have the same passage in Ezekiel in mind for both Revelation 19 and Revelation 20? Doesn't John know that Revelation 19 has Jesus returning, and then we have a thousand-year kingdom, and it's only after that millennium that the events of Revelation 20 play out? since Revelation 20, verses 1 through 6, mention the 1,000 years several times. Doesn't John know that? Well, the point is that maybe John doesn't know that. Maybe John isn't thinking of this chronology. Maybe his repurposing of Ezekiel 38 and 39 in both chapters indicates that both chapters describe the same event, the return of Christ and the defeat of Satan. Now, many commentators who do not hold to a dispensational premillennial reading of Revelation, okay, will take this view. They believe that Revelation is not to be read in a linear chronological fashion, but that its events, the three series of the seven judgments, are to be read instead in cycles. That is, the three series describe the same seven cyclical events on earth. This is known as the recapitulation reading of the book of Revelation. Now, Meredith Klein, whose article I've referenced in part one on Harmageddon, okay, he's one of the few evangelicals to see the divine council stuff in Revelation. Klein was one who believes that this back-to-back use in Revelation 19 and 20 of Ezekiel 38 and 39 means that the two chapters describe the same event. That would in turn mean that there is no intervening 1,000-year period. The 1,000-year reference just means a long time and applies to the period that precedes the second coming, the period in which we now live, the so-called church age. And if this is the right reading, the 1,000-year millennial kingdom vanishes. And that's what Klein says in his article. He refers to this as the death of premillennial eschatology, because you collapse verses or chapters 19 and 20 into each other. And if you're dealing with the second coming at the day of the Lord, then the period that precedes the second coming and the defeat of Satan, the period that precedes Revelation 20, verses 7 through 10, is not a 1,000-year literal millennial kingdom. It's the period in which we now live. And that makes the premillennial system implode, according to Klein. Okay? Now, Klein is an amillennialist, and again, he uses a lot of the Old Testament imagery that is there, and it's legit, it's there, to make premillennialism collapse. And if you are a premillennialist, I don't want this to discourage you from reading Klein's article. It's actually really good. But this is where he winds up. Now, I would say Klein's reading is certainly possible, but it could be also that John does use Ezekiel 38 and 39 to describe different events, just because he wants to do that. In other words, he picks something from Ezekiel 39 to describe something at the second coming, and then he picks something from Ezekiel 38 and 39 to describe this event after a millennium. You, as a premillennialist, you could argue that, okay, John's using Ezekiel 38 and 39 in both passages. Whoop-de-doo. You know, he's using the Gog and Magog passage both times. He uses different elements of it. Big deal. We don't have to collapse the two to themselves into one unit, thus eliminating, you know, a 1,000-year reign before these events happen. That turns the 1,000-year reign into the church age. We don't have to do that like the amillennialist does. We can acknowledge that John is using Ezekiel 38 and 39 in both passages and still work the system. And you can. You can do that. I would also add, even if Klein is correct, let's just assume that Klein is correct, and the 1,000-year references in Revelation 20 have nothing to do with a 1,000-year millennial kingdom. It refers to the church age preceding the second coming. Let's just go with what Klein says. Well, guess what? That doesn't rule out a literal earthly kingdom of the Messiah. Why not? Because you have one right after. You have the new earth. Okay, you have a kingdom on the new earth with the Messiah ruling. Now, many amillers want the kingdom to be the church age period. That's all they're interested in. And then the new earth talk, you know, in Revelation 21 and 22, that's just talk about heaven. That's just all symbolic about heaven, wherever that is. Well, that's a guess. I would suggest, again, that the talk in Revelation 21 and 22 is an earthly kingdom, because that's where it is. It's on Earth. It's a new Eden. It's a global Eden. And I don't think that's accidental. I think that's deliberate. Now, all of this is why I say, when I get asked about eschatological systems, this is why I say I don't care about the systems. Who gives a rip? Okay, I think there is recapitulation and revelation, but I also think there's some linear chronology there too. I don't think it has to be an either or. I think it's a both and. And I also think that the final new earth is the earthly kingdom of God. We're going to get that. And if that's the case, then to limit it to 1,000 years, it makes the kingdom too small, too short, too brief. I'm interested in and believe in a future earthly kingdom of the reigning Messiah over all the nations, and we as believers reigning with him, displacing the fallen sons of God who now rule over them. That is what I think biblical eschatology describes. I don't care how it fits into a system or if it fits into a system. I don't care about systems. You know, if you want your system, I've just given you the way it can work if you're an amiller or a premiller. But personally, I just don't care about the systems. I'm interested in how the book ends. Okay, and again, it ends on Earth. I think to capture, you know, to reclaim the nations involves events happening on Earth and a kingdom on Earth. That's where I'm at, and that's why. So to wrap up, what's Gog and Magog, Ezekiel 38 and 39, about? It's an event associated with and ended by the second coming. It's the day of the Lord. It's not a battle that occurs years earlier than the second coming. How that plays out in terms of human participants, you know, the precise identifying which human nations and armies is anybody's guess. That is secondary. The important point is that Gog is a Satan figure, and the battle describes Satan's last gasp at robbing Yahweh of his people and his kingdom.
Mike, you mentioned in the Unseen Realm about Irenaeus. Notice that the word Titan added up to 666 in Greek, Gematria. Mm-hmm. Leviathan was a Titan, so that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is. And again, that is something that's I discussed in chapter 11 in Reversing Hermon as well. There are other gematric approaches to that you know are worth thinking about too.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike, we might as well just cover the book of Revelation. Come on. Just get it over with. It's like pulling the Band-Aid off. Let's just do it.
It's just a convoluted mess.
Let's just do it and get it over with. Let's that way you can just put it behind you and move on.
I'll tell you what turns me off about it is you end up spending half of every episode talking about systems.
Well, can you cover it without covering the systems?
Probably not, because when you say something, you have to say, now you've probably heard this different thing over here, and that's because you've been taught this system, or this might be really familiar to you, you know, what you were taught in church, and your Christian neighbor doesn't believe that because you've got different systems, you know. So you always end up talking about how the book is taught and the presumptions therein to the book, you know. And at the end of the day, everybody's guessing. So I do think there is recapitulation. There really is something to that. But you can't just use that and say, well, nothing in the book is chronological. That, you know, again, it's just, that's the kind of overstatement you get when people are defending hermeneutics and specific systems. And you just have to muck through all of that every time you say anything about, you know, any particular passage in the book. I think it's easy to get lost in all that.
Well, we can do a naked Bible version of it. Sure, you can mention some systems, but you can...
Naked revelation.
Yeah. We can get naked with it.
No.
All right. Well, we'll get pieces here and there, I guess. And Mike, next week, it'll be our 20th Q&A show. So
that's astonishing.
Get ready for that. Yeah.
Yep.
All right, Mike. Well, I just want to remind everybody, if you haven't done so and you're on Facebook, please go like the Naked Bible podcast page or go join the Naked Bible group. Lots of great conversations and great minds in the group talking about similar content. So please do that if you have not. And with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.